From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, urban violence. Rochelle and Anthony Yates lost their 5-year-old son, Marcus, in 1988. He was caught in the crossfire of two drug dealers who brought their feud to a neighborhood candy store. The Yates have become community activists, working to keep drug dealers out of neighborhoods and to stop the violence. Also today, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, The Information, by Martin Amis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Guns and drugs have turned many American neighborhoods into war zones. 16 people have been killed this year in one Philadelphia neighborhood. In the entire city, 14 children, 17 years old and younger, have died violently so far this year. My guests, Anthony and Rochelle Yates, lost their 5-year-old son, Marcus, in the crossfire of a drug shootout in a Philadelphia candy store back in 1988. Their middle son and their nephew were wounded in the same shootout. The Yates have become community activists, working to keep drug dealers out of neighborhoods and to stop the violence. They speak at schools and work with community groups. Anthony Yates works in the Philadelphia Sheriff's Office. Rochelle Yates has turned their house into a daycare center and home for foster children. I asked Anthony Yates to describe what happened the day his son was killed.
It was July the 18th, 1988, and my wife and I both were at work. So before going to work, we left the children with their grandmother on 59th and Springfield. And there's all of their cousins and some, you know, our nieces and nephews. So I think there was a total of, 11 family members that were with their grandmother. They all decided that to go to a candy store which is on the corner of 60th and Springfield, where they have a lot of video games and a lot of penny candy. And all the kids got together and went down there. While they were there playing the games and being as children are, you know, trying to buy this and buy that for the little bit of pennies they had, two Jamaican drug dealers decided that they have an argument in the store about who's taking over the corner as far as drug sales are concerned. In the interim, one of them left, went and got a gun and came back. Now, these two drug dealers, in the midst of all these children in between them, decided to have a shootout. One ran to the back, the other ran to the front. The kids were trapped in the middle, and they just fired. And I think there was a total of 14 rounds fired. One, unfortunately, you know, hit our baby, and he was killed instantly. The other one hit Malcolm twice.
Is he your older son?
Yes, my older son.
Your middle son.
Right, the middle son. And one hit our nephew, Micah, hit him in the foot. Like I say, we were at work. So on the way home from work, I stopped and picked my wife up. And we come back to Springfield Avenue. There's a multitude of police, emergency wagons, and I inadvertently made a statement to my wife, the situation's getting crazy out here. This has got to stop, and I'm guaranteeing they shot somebody's child, not knowing it was our kids. And when we got there, our kids were already in the hospital. They were already gone from the scene. The only ones there was our 11-year-old at the time, which is our oldest son, Tony. And needless to say, he was hysterical. He's trying to explain to us what happened. I'm trying to find out from a friend of mine what went on that apparently was just about an eyewitness to the situation, especially of them bringing the kids out. My mother-in-law, she was gone. She was at the hospital already. So we went to the hospital, and then we found out the status of our children. And needless to say, I don't even know what we thought that day. It was just numb. It's just a numbing, terrifying day. Yeah.
You had one son who was not hit, at all by gunfire, did he hide under a table or anything?
Yes. At that point, he, well, it's like a candy store of video games and arcade machines. And the older children, they hit on the floor. They, you know, they laid flat on the floor. And by my son, he just turned 5. He didn't know. He was looking at the candy, trying to figure out what he's going to buy. And my older child was trying to tell him to drop down and come crawl over to him. But so much confusion going on, he didn't know what was going on. So he ran to him. And when he fell, when the bullet hit his temple of his head, he landed right exactly at my older child's foot. And my older son put his finger inside the wound of his head to try to stop the bleeding. I don't know where he got that type of knowledge of how to, stop the bleeding. But it was just something he did. He called himself saving his brother's life. And he held his finger over there for a while. But he said, Mom, the blood kept coming out. And so he just felt that he had to run out of the store, which he did. He ran between the gunmen and went to call the police. So he called the police. He was the first one to call the police.
Wow. What was the emotional impact on your two surviving sons, son who was hit and the son who
traumatic,
escaped?
Traumatic. They changed completely. I have two totally different children in front of me at this point. They were fun, outgoing, loving, caring, and they became withdrawn. My older child became very hostile. My younger son is very introverted. He stays in his room. He doesn't come out. He more so like kind of hides behind me and his father. We go out, he's right there. He doesn't like to go anywhere without us. And he's almost 14 years old and he still feels this way. And it's not normal. They're not really living a normal childhood. They had to grow up fast. They act older. They talk older. They have no kind of happy-go-lucky attitude anymore. They're very cautious of people. And my younger one always looked around, over his shoulder, because he always said, Mom, I just feel like somebody's watching me or somebody's behind me. And at this day, he still says that when I take him out, he's always looking over his shoulder.
He's the one who was shot.
Yes.
Yes. And because of the situation, they were just stripped of their childhood. Like she says, they were just forced to grow up. I mean, they were forced to be very cautious of everyone. And even when he went to school, tried to return to school after going through therapy and different bereavement classes. And even when he returned to school here in Philadelphia, the kids would always say, let me see where you were shot at, And, kids are just brutally honest, Let me see, where the bullet wound was. So he really didn't want to go back to school. And like she said, the older one, Tony, he became very defiant. He came very much against the system. And, we had to get them a lot of help.
Came from a straight-A student to all
His grades deteriorated.
He was almost basically at the level where he failed. And he was an A-B student all his life. And then his grades dropped drastically.
And the thing about it that people do not understand is people feel as though there's a certain amount of time, then you're supposed to be over that.
Mm-hmm.
The grief is supposed to be gone. You're supposed to continue on life as usual. Such is not the case. That stays with you for the rest of your life. And you try to do what you can to continue on. But there's no, it's been 6 months or a year, you snap out of it now, it's time to continue on. It doesn't work like that.
So your two surviving sons went in totally opposite directions. One became withdrawn and afraid, and the other became defiant.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
For the one that became defiant, did he become involved with violence himself?
No.
No, he didn't. We were very fortunate in the fact that we were able to send him away to upstate Pennsylvania to school.
To a boarding school?
More or less, it's a
military boarding school.
Oh.
By myself being a Vietnam veteran, I was able to enroll them in a school for veterans' children. And they're both in junior ROTC now, and one's ready to graduate, and the other one's coming along very well. He's in the Honor Guard drill team, and he's playing the trombone, of all things.
Oh, great.
And they're getting better. They're getting much, much better.
When your older son became defiant, was that a rebellion against you both?
No.
No authority.
Against authority.
But not your authority?
Mm-mm.
No.
So against teachers, cops?
Teachers.
Anyone in an authoritarian position. And he didn't trust any authority.
Now, what position did that put you in? I mean, you were really disillusioned yourselves. So did you tell him, did you understand his lack of respect? Did you try to just convince him that he had to be more respectful? What position did you take?
We definitely understood his lack of respect. We understood why he felt he couldn't trust adults anymore. And we tried to, like I said, we tried to get him help. We get him therapy and put him in type of, you know, counseling classes and things like that. And we also, well, he respected us at home, but, and he never had like too much to a point where he was totally disrespectful to adults. Mm-hmm. It's just that
he didn't trust him.
He didn't trust him. That's why I guess that's basically that he didn't trust him at all. And he stands away from him and he's very cold. And they'll talk to him. He just wouldn't, he'll just look at you, you know. Like, why are you talking
very
to me?
Little,
you
yeah,
know, no emotions, no feelings whatsoever. And it took a while.
Now, did the discipline of the military school help them right away? Or did your older son become defiant of the authorities
no,
in military
I
school,
think,
too?
I think more or less our religious background and in the way that my wife and I brought him up, and more or less the fact that he had the opportunity to leave the city. The congestion and the confusion of the inner city, I think him being away was a release and an opportunity for him to see how others lived in other situations without all the violence and the negativity of the city.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Rochelle and Anthony Yates, and their youngest son was shot and killed in the crossfire of a drug shootout back in 1988. The neighborhood you live in is different, or the neighborhood you were living in at the time in 1988 is a different neighborhood than the neighborhood that Rochelle, your mother, lived in. Where
yes, it was.
Where the kids were. Was your neighborhood a safer neighborhood?
Did yes,
the,
it was.
Did the children feel safer at your house?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. My mother's neighborhood, basically, it, you know, a lot of things was happening in that neighborhood. The neighborhood was changing, and different type of people were coming in the neighborhood, and a lot of people were leaving. And so it was almost always a problem there. It seemed like it was always a racial problem or maybe economical problem. So it really, it was different, definitely different. Because the house that they were raised in with us, it was my house when I was younger. I was also living there when I was a child. So the surroundings was very comfortable, very familiar. Everybody knew them, you know.
But you didn't feel that felt safe enough
no.
for them?
No.
Not after that situation. No. Because unfortunately, a week before that happened, a little boy, Ralph Brooks, was shot. He was paralyzed.
In your neighborhood?
No. In North Philadelphia.
South Philadelphia.
And unfortunately, he's in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. And that made us both start taking, paying closer attention to what's going on in the street. And then 6-7 days later, it was our children.
Well, not so much the neighborhood. It was the school where my son was going to school at. Mm-hmm. They had to walk past drug dealers.
Right.
They had to walk past all type of elements out there. And that bothered me. You know, I can't see my son being a victim of a drug-related incident and have to walk by the same type of people to go to school. It was just really was messing with his head, and he really wasn't able to accept that. So he needed to go to a school that was not in the community.
And for some time, my sons, including myself, were in a period of denial. You know, they didn't want to believe that their brother was killed and was gone. And even though my wife, my kids were getting therapy, I didn't want no part of it. You know, I denied the fact that I may need help. And I tried to deal with it on my own. And it wasn't easy. You know, it's a thing I would never want no one else to have to deal with, to have to go through. But I think one of the first things you do is you go into denial. You know, you don't want to face up to the fact that my main thing was I'm a grown man. I've served 2 tours in Vietnam, 10 years in the Marine Corps. I'm raising a family. I should be able to protect my family. I come home and this happens and I lose one of my sons and almost lose the other. That made me deny a whole lot as a man in this country. And it really made me question, you know, just what type of world are we living in?
And you're saying, too, that you felt guilty even though it wasn't your fault at all.
Oh, yeah, because
exactly.
My kids are supposed to be able to walk the street. They're supposed to be able to go anywhere they want to go. When I hear reporters say, it was an unfortunate situation, your son was just at the wrong place at the wrong time, I snap out at them. There's no such thing as the wrong place at the wrong time for a child. We are protectors of those children. And if we don't do it, then there's no tomorrow.
So was there a point where you decided you wanted help and you wanted counseling?
No.
You never got it. So how did you get through the experience? Was there a period where you felt like you were starting to understand things that you hadn't understood before about your own reaction?
I started coming to grips with it after a while, but I think, I know the only help that I got was through my prayers and my belief in God, mm-hmm. and that he would take us through this. And that's what brought me through.
My guests are Anthony and Rochelle Yates. Their 5-year-old son, Marcus, was killed in the crossfire of a drug shootout in 1988. The Yates have since become community activists. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Rochelle and Anthony Yates. Their 5-year-old son, Marcus, was killed in the crossfire of a drug shootout. I'm thinking about how hard it must have been to decide whether to send your children to the military academy or not. I mean, their safety was more ensured by sending them away, but at the same time, you'd lost a son, and now you're going to send two of them far away.
And that's what really angered me. I think I was at that point where I was really angry at society. I said, I can't. They took my youngest son, my baby boy, and now they taking my other two boys because I can't take my other two sons because I can't trust them to live here among the other people in this society. So now I'm a long distance mother. I resent that very much. And every time they come home, I just cherish every precious minute I have with them, and it's very hard. It's very hard to have your children, being a mom long distance. Because you don't get a chance to see them do the things that you want to see them do and grow and ask you all the questions. And so it's been a struggle. It's definitely been a struggle.
Did you ever feel like they misunderstood and they felt that you were pushing them away?
Well, at this point, I did. I did push them away.
I think they kind of felt that at first.
At first, for the first maybe the year, I pushed all my children away because I couldn't handle it. I just felt that I was a bad mother. I felt that I couldn't protect my one child, then I don't deserve any children. And so I was into this, denial, this guilt-ridden stage, and I just kind of blocked them out of my mind. I just walked around like I didn't have any kids. It was totally devastating. I was totally depressed.
It was really rough.
And I know my kids felt it, but we all were grieving at different ways, and I just felt very guilty, and I just felt that they would be better off with somebody else.
What changed for you? Was it the counseling that helped you understand
your reaction?
Well,
the counseling helped me, and my church was behind me, and the prayers of people that pray for me, and it brought me through.
And one problem we have here is that even our city government and our state government, unfortunately, has no provisions for situations of that nature. When we went through that situation, there was no place to get help except for this one lady that started an organization of her own, a bereavement center, Dr. Wanda Jenkins, and she sought us.
Well, they had a special program, I think, for families of homicide victims.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right.
So she found you?
Yes, she heard about us.
She contacted us.
And she contacted us at the right time because when she came to the house, all the men in my family were out looking for the guys who murdered my son. And they were all rallying there that day to look for those guys. And she came knocking on the door, and everybody was ready to leave. And she said, can you just take your coat off and let me talk to you for a while? And by her coming in there doing that, it might have saved another life.
So the men in your family were going out to hunt these guys down?
Yes, at all costs.
No doubt about it, no question.
Anthony, were you involved in that too?
Oh, yes.
Did you realize what you were doing?
Oh, yeah. I knew exactly what I was doing. And to me, it was the right thing to do. And if I would have ran into those individuals, then I'd be doing time now, without a doubt. So I don't have any question in my mind about that.
Was that in part like your military training kicking in too, that you knew how to deal with this?
Maybe it was some. a lot of it was revenge. A lot of it was because of the fact that I couldn't understand how these two individuals could be so callous and so uncaring about human life. And it really kicked in when we had to go to trial. And to see those two individuals sitting side by side, laughing and joking with each other, like they were buddies, when a little while ago they tried to kill one another, and in the interim killed my son. That was hard to deal with.
Michelle, when you saw the men of your family getting ready to hunt the killers down, did you try to stop them, or were you...
No, I was...
You thought it was a good idea, too?
No, at the point, I was in so much pain. I didn't even realize what was going on. I knew they all got together, too, to try to find the guys, but I was in such another world. It's just that I didn't even relate to it. It was just like, you do what you have to do, you know?
What did the woman from the grief counseling program say to you that changed your mind?
She had a lot to say because she went through the same thing but with her mother. And what she said made a lot of sense. And it made me stop and think that I didn't want to throw my life away when I still had three other kids to raise. And, you know, it made me start understanding the senselessness of what I was getting ready to do, because it was involving some good people, and they were going to go with me no matter what. And she slowed us down, made us think.
You have a daughter who I believe was conceived the weekend that your son was shot.
Yeah, she was born right around that time.
Yes, she was, and it was a miracle because I didn't want any more kids.
That was a gift. It happened at the time when we were at our worst. And by her being born, that took some of the focus and let us understand that, you know, we still have to live and that, you know, life has to go on.
Yes, I was totally upset when I found that I was pregnant.
Oh, yeah.
I said, how could he do this to me? I said, God, how could you do this to me?
Because she didn't want any more children. She didn't want nothing else to do with any more children.
I just felt that I have no control of my life. I think I had no... Till this day, when my children walk out the door, I'm terrified, you know. Not as much as I used to be, but they have to call me. They have to... I have to know where they were every minute of the day. And by my son being a teenager, it was kind of difficult for him. But I said, well, you know how I am. You have to let me know when you get to from point A to point B. And if you're going to stop between A and B, call me, you know. I need to know where you are. I need to know. And he'd be waiting for the bus, and he'll call me. He'll stop at another bus stop. He'll call me, you know. So he got used to it, and he didn't complain about it anymore. But wherever he is, wherever they go, I needed to know. My middle child, he wouldn't go anywhere, so I didn't have to worry about him. But the older one did.
Does your daughter know about her brother who was killed?
Ironically, yes, she does.
That's
she gets strange. This depression sometime, and she says she misses her brother. I said, well, how do you miss a brother you've never seen, you know? And she has these crying spells at night, and she comes down, and I said, what's the matter? She said, I miss my brother. And it's been so, she acts like him. She took
same
everything is
spirit.
Identical to him, except same. She's a girl. And it's so and it's strange, it's scary sometimes. Same personality, the same wit. She's very witty, very smart child. And it scares us a lot of times. So
it's like he was reincarnated as a girl.
Huh, right.
It's really strange.
It's really amazing.
Really, I tell you, people always say, boy, she's just like Marcus. And I said, yes, she is. That's the only thing, she got pigtails, you know?
Rochelle and Anthony Yates, their 5-year-old son Marcus was killed in the crossfire of a drug shootout in 1988. The Yates have since become community activists. They'll be back in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our talk with Rochelle and Anthony Yates. In 1988, their 5-year-old son Marcus was killed in the crossfire between rival drug dealers. Both of these drug dealers are now in prison. The Yates will tell us about the trial and about what they're doing now to help children and to prevent violence. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the novel The Information by Martin Amis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are Rochelle and Anthony Yates. Their 5-year-old son, Marcus, was killed in 1988. He was caught in the crossfire of two feuding drug dealers who took their fight to a candy store in southwest Philadelphia. In the first part of our show, the Yates told us about the murder and how it affected the lives of their two older sons. After the murder, the men of the family were ready to take the law into their own hands and track down the killers. But they were talked out of it at the last minute and let the criminal justice system do its job. Let's talk about the trial a little bit and what that process was like for you. Anthony, I'm trying to think of what it was like for you to sit in the trial of the two men who were accused of murdering your son, considering that you were not too long before that hoping to go out and get them yourself.
Sure. The hardest thing about it was our judicial system. Our judicial system denied us to go into court the first day because of the fact that the defendants said that we were a threat to them. And so we were asked by the judge to be removed from the courtroom. And we never seen these individuals, never had any words with them. Just on their say-so, our system decided that they would close the court to us after waiting 18 months to find out exactly what happened in that store because our kids wouldn't talk about it and we didn't try to talk to them about it.
What I read in the paper was that you both weren't allowed in the courtroom until your kids had already testified.
Yes, but I would not allow my son to, especially my youngest son who was 6, I would not allow him to be there without me because he was already terrified. He was already withdrawn.
Yeah, he was definitely.
And I just didn't feel like that he should have some type of support there for him. So my mother and a couple other people that were allowed in the courtroom, they came out and gave us like kind of account of what happened.
So your son did testify even though you weren't?
Yes, because he did have people there that he knew, that he felt comfortable with.
Rochelle, what was it like for you to sit in the courtroom and look at the two men accused of shooting your son?
I tell you, I was very angry. I was so angry and so outraged. They humiliated us. They humiliated my children.
In the courtroom?
In the courtroom. One of them was, matter of fact, I was in the courtroom because I remember seeing him. I was in with one son. I didn't go in with the other son, but I was in with my youngest son. And he was like telling him, I'm going to get you or something like that, really trying to intimidate him. And also they cussed at me, you know, defendants cussed at me and my husband and rolled their eyes and made snide remarks and read the newspaper and went to sleep.
They just totally did not care. You know, it was no big thing to them. You know, and it's just so hard to understand and to put into words how it is to sit in that courtroom and hear them describe exactly what killed our son and exactly how he died. And for them two to sit there and
no remorse,
you know.
Not 1 ounce.
You know, very callous, you know. And like I say, when they were being transported back and forth from the cell room, you know, they would look over at us and say a few words. But there was no way I could get to them anyway. So we tried to just deal with it and let the court system handle it. Which was the hardest thing I ever did in my life.
What, letting them do it instead of doing it yourself? Both of the men were found guilty of murder in the first degree, and then after that, one of them had their sentence changed. A judge said that there was no intent to murder on the part of one of them, so mm-hmm. that his.
But that didn't happen. We went to Supreme Court, mm-hmm. and it was overturned.
It was overturned. The overturning was overturned.
Yes.
So he was given first degree again.
Yes.
So both of the men are now serving life sentences.
Exactly. Natural life sentences, plus I think about was it 16 years for the assault on Malcolm. They're serving life for the death of Marcus, but then they're serving extra time for the assault on Malcolm after they finish a natural life sentence. So they'll never be out.
No, I think that the jury was asked to consider the death penalty. Would you have felt any better or any worse if one or two of the killers had gotten the death penalty?
To tell you the truth, at that time, I was hoping they did receive the death penalty.
You were hoping they would get
the
death penalty?
Yes, and I don't believe in it because I'm a born-again Christian. But it was so much that went inside me, and I see that they had no remorse, none whatsoever. I just felt that why waste, what is it, $45,000 a year to house a prisoner? Why waste that time? Why waste that money on the person who don't care a darn about our children? So at that time, yes, I did hope that they both got the death penalty.
And now?
No, I don't feel that way. I don't have no right to take a life. I don't believe that anybody have the right to take a life. What they did was wrong, but they will have to pay for that. They will pay for their action in the long run.
Anthony, what about you?
I don't know. I'm still dealing with that issue. I don't know. That issue is still going over and over in my mind and in my head, and I haven't come to no clear decision on that.
My guests are Anthony and Rochelle Yates. Their 5-year-old son, Marcus, was killed in the crossfire of a shootout in 1988. The Yates have since become community activists. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Rochelle and Anthony Yates. Their 5-year-old son was killed in the crossfire of a drug shootout at a neighborhood candy store in 1988. At what point did both of you start to feel like you had to do something besides grieving, that you had to try to do something to help other children or to try to stop other acts of violence, to protect children?
Well, for me, I noticed in every time I read the paper, every time I look at the TV, my heart just grieves, and I'm always in tears. My husband said, "What's the matter?" I said, "Another child got shot or killed or abused," and it was just to the point where it was consuming my life. And he knew that I had to do something. And I would go to the parents of people whose child has been shot, and I go talk to them. I go through the neighborhood and talk to them. I call them on the phone. I call the newspaper to see if I can get the address. I just had to be there to support that mother who lost that child. And it was just like an obsession with me. And I knew I had to help these children because nobody was looking out for them. Nobody cared about them. They had no rights. They can't vote, so they have no rights. And it was just that the Lord told me, well, you have to do something for these children who can't take care of themselves. And so I opened my home. I always have kids in my house, always, even before I had foster children or the daycare. I always have, always like a surrogate mother, I guess, to all the teenagers in the neighborhood. So it was just a need that I needed to do this.
And Anthony, was there a turning point for you where you started to feel like you wanted to take some kind of action?
Yes. After seeing all the grief that my kids and especially my wife was going through, and then continuously, as I say, after this happened, it seems as though it brought everything to the forefront. It seems as though every time you pick up a paper, it was the same situation. And I just could no longer deal with that, you know. There had to be a difference, you know. So I felt as though I knew some individuals that felt the same way I did, and we got together, and we started making that difference.
So tell us each what you're doing. Now, Anthony, you mentioned that you try to keep the drug dealers off your street.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you feel?
Well, any opportunity. There's been plenty of opportunities where people still would like for us to talk to kids at different high schools.
So when you go to schools, you talk to other...
Other children.
Other teenagers. And try to talk the teenagers out of a violent life.
Yeah, it's surprising. After my wife and I finished with a discussion that we have with the children, and we asked any of the children if they would like to talk to us alone, they designate a room, and that room is packed with kids that has problems at home, drug problems and other problems at home, abuse problems, and they want help. These children want to be helped. You know, it's not like the mass media is painting this picture that they're a lost generation. That's not the case. These kids want help. It's just the help is not there.
What can you do for them at that point?
The most we can do is try to console them, try to point them in the right direction where there is some type of shelter or some type of safety net for them. The main thing is like everything else in the city and in the state government now, funding. Right. To do things for people.
For prevention, any more prevention measures.
That is definitely needed.
Michelle, you bought a larger house so that you could open up your doors and provide daycare for children and take in foster children.
Yes.
How big is your house now?
Well, we have a 6-bedroom house at this point, and now it's getting too small. So we really do need to move, and I would like to move in a nicer neighborhood that the kids can feel more comfortable. But at this time, we won't be able to do that, financially able to do that. But we do try to provide them a nice home and something more acceptable than where they're accustomed to coming from.
Much better atmosphere.
So.
How many foster children at a time do you
usually
have?
Well, usually I have 5.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And do you choose who the children will be?
No, I just, whatever. They knock on the door and say, Ms. Yates, I need your help. I said, ring them on. That doesn't make a difference to me.
So do the children usually show up with a lot of problems?
Oh, definitely.
What kind of problems?
Definitely. One little boy we had, he was definitely a drug-addicted baby. He had no motor skills. He had no movement. He just laid there just like lifeless. And he was 4 months old. And every time the social workers come over, they just can't believe the progress that he made. He left me when he left me in December. And he's running and he's in everything, and they just cannot believe, you know, that this boy came from what they seen. And everybody come over to say, let me see this little boy, you know, let me see him, you know. And they'd be so surprised that that's a little love and a little attention. It works wonders.
So most of the foster children are very young.
I have some that's 8 years old, 11 years old, so no, not all young. But the one that I had the most problems with were the babies that were drug addicted. I had children who lived in a roach-infested home where that never ate, didn't even know what a bathtub, you know, what water was, a bath was, what a bath was. So when I put him in a bubble bath, he was scared because he didn't know what the bubbles were, you know. So it was really...
Some of them were in bad shape.
They were in bad shape, and they eat, and they stuff food in their mouth, and they keep it in there, and they sleep with it in their mouth because they think they won't get another meal. So it's kind of hard to try to let them understand that this food will be here for you. It's just really heartbreaking.
What's your neighborhood like now?
Mm-hmm. It's like any neighborhood in Philadelphia. I don't think there's any place you can go that it's not the same situations going on in the neighborhood. It's not as prevalent as other neighborhoods, but some problems do exist. You know, and we do what we can as neighbors on that block to try to, you know, alleviate those problems.
What can you do?
We can get out there and let the people know by show of force. Letting those know that want to deal in those drugs, that want to deal in the activity of carrying weapons, that they're not going to do it on our block. That if they do, this is what they're going to suffer, and this is who they're going to see.
So how do you get that message out?
By being there.
They go out there and talk to the guys. They make
a
move.
By being there, by stopping them as soon as we see them.
You stop drug dealers and talk with them. How do you stop them?
By just going up to them, let them know, look, I live in this neighborhood. You're not bringing this in my neighborhood. And whatever it is that you do, whatever it is you think you can do, the same thing is going to be done to yourself in this neighborhood. You won't bring it here.
Is that effective?
Oh, yeah. Because they understand you're not playing.
Well, do they ever...
You cannot be... You're not afraid.
They're probably the one who has the gun, though, not you. So do they try to intimidate you when you're talking to
them? I haven't been threatened or intimidated by any of them to my face. I've heard a lot of rumors, but I don't worry about that. You know. So, yeah, I'm a firm believer dealing with any problem head on.
Do you think that things are at the point in Philadelphia where people are getting numb to the number of homicides?
Or? Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Most definitely.
How do you see that? How can you?
The reaction of children. Do you have a reaction of children? The children see or hear about another child being killed, and it's not devastating anymore. It's over with, you know. So-and-so ain't gotten shot. It's like no big thing.
Well, how can you get around the numbing?
I don't know. For some reason, it's been happening so often that it's like desensitized people.
Yeah.
You know, it's
I think
like,
they have to start caring again. I think people need to start caring
about
one another again.
About one another. You know, that's what's lost.
And people don't care about each other anymore.
You know, people walk down the street now, and if you speak, it's like you've done something wrong. You know, they're afraid of you. Mm-hmm. You know, when we grew up at a time when we hardly even locked doors, you know, at night. You stay on the porch all night with your friends, you know what I mean? You could walk anywhere in the city you wanted to walk. All that is gone. All those values have to be brought back. I know it's a cliche you hear time and time again, but it's very true.
Yeah.
It takes a whole village to raise one child, you know, just not the people in that area.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Rochelle and Anthony Yates live in Philadelphia. Their youngest son was killed 5 years ago. Anthony now works in the sheriff's office. Rochelle has turned their house into a daycare center and home for foster children. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have from Oklahoma City?
Well, we'll have a report from NPR's Wade Goodwin, who is in Oklahoma City, on today's developments there as the search continues. We'll also be hearing from Mike Schuster on the chronology of the investigation into the bombing, and a talk with sociologist and communitarian Amitai Etzioni about the tension between individual liberties and steps that might be taken now to prevent terrorist acts like the bombing in Oklahoma City. Also on the program, Nina Totenberg reports on today's Supreme Court ruling throwing out a law that bans guns near schools and what the new nominee to head the CIA says he'll do once he gets there.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In Martin Amis's new novel, The Information, the main character, Richard Tull, is working on a book entitled The History of Increasing Humiliation. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that title just about sums up the treatment Martin Amis has been receiving in the press.
You've got to hand it to the Brits. These days, they may not be a more literate people than we are, but they still seem much more interested in the literary world. In the past 6 months, British TV and tabloids have had a field day covering Martin Amis's marathon midlife crisis. First, Amis left his wife for another woman. Then he dumped his longtime agent, the wife of one of his closest friends, fellow novelist Julian Barnes. Subsequently, Amis signed up with American mega-agent Andrew Wiley, nicknamed the Jackal, who reportedly negotiated an unheard-of $800,000 advance for his new novel, The Information. Amis claimed he needed the money to repair his crumbling middle-aged teeth, but resentful colleagues like A.S. Byatt publicly accused him of greed. Byatt even groused that Amis's dental surgery was a mere cosmetic indulgence, a high crime in a country where bad teeth are as emblematic as Big Ben. In an eerie way, The Information anticipates much of Amis's present real-life mess. It charts the progress of an all-consuming literary envy. Its anti-heroic narrator, Richard Tull, is a 40-year-old flop novelist whose latest effort, entitled Untitled, is a modernist nightmare which boasts 16 unreliable narrators and has hospitalized nearly every editor who's tried to read it. Richard ruefully compares Untitled to Marie Curie's notebooks, even today, a century on, still carcinogenic. When The Information opens, Richard is tormented by thoughts of his oldest and stupidest friend, Gwyn Barry. Gwyn has become a major novelist, though not in Richard's estimation. About Gwyn's second novel, a utopian romance entitled Ameliore, Richard mutters, Ameliore would only be remarkable if Gwyn had written it with his foot. Ameliore Revisited has just become a bestseller, and Gwyn has been nominated for the Profundity Requital, a Nobel-like prize which pays an annuity for life. Unable to suffer his outrageous fortune any longer, Richard resolves that he's not only going to screw up Gwyn's literary career, but also Gwyn's life. But first, he embarks with Gwyn on an ego-shredding joint author tour of the States. Amos has visited our shores before in his nonfiction book, flatteringly entitled The Moronic Inferno, as well as in his wicked novel, Money. And he hasn't mellowed much on the U.S. since then. Through Richard, Amos also skewers every facet of the writing life: agents, publishers, reviewers, readings, and readers. What raises the information above simply being a riotous but hollow literary rant is Amos's language. He's so deft, so nimble, it's like he's creating new sentences for articulating self-consciousness the way Picasso created new possibilities for painting the modern self. Amos dwells on those ugly little emotions, like self-pity and passive-aggressive loathing, that other, higher-minded novelists sidestep. And Amos bravely owns up to the naked yearning that lurks beneath cynicism. At one point, Richard confesses that, like all writers, he wanted and expected the reverence due, say, to the warrior Christ an hour before Armageddon. So, is the information worth that scandalous $800,000 advance? Well, consider that Regis and Kathy Lee probably make that much in 1 week, whereas Amos worked 5 years to create a savagely funny novel that also makes readers think seriously about art and mortality. In my opinion, I hope Martin Amos is laughing all the way to the bank.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Information by Martin Amos. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, and Fred Snyder. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Alan, too, directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Cagney and Lacey. A new 2-hour movie reunites the two women cops. We'll talk with actresses Tyne Daly and Sharon Gless. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air. Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviews Dorothy Farabee as
Fresh Air. Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Oklahomans remembered victims from last week's bombing today. They observed a minute of silence at 9:02 Central Time. That is when the blast occurred 1 week ago. The death toll now stands at 98. 14 of the dead are children. Searchers found two more bodies in the building overnight. Officials say the death toll is going to rise. They're trying to dig into the area where the daycare center was located. High winds have slowed the search in some parts of the bombed-out building. Meanwhile, the Associated Press is quoting a law enforcement source who says three people say they saw suspect Timothy McVeigh in front of the federal building a few minutes before it was blown up. Arab American groups are urging Congress not to jeopardize immigrant rights as lawmakers work on anti-terrorism legislation. They say some of the proposals now under consideration are extremely unfair. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The Arab Anti-Discrimination League says as the target of terrorist attacks itself, it wholeheartedly supports some of the criminal provisions in the counterterrorism proposals before Congress. But it says some proposals go too far, such as allowing secret trials to deport suspected terrorists without the normal due process rights of confronting your accuser. The League says Abraham Ahmad, the Jordanian-born Oklahoma City resident who was wrongly suspected of being involved in last week's bombing, could have been wrongly deported under the new law had he not been an American citizen. For his part, Ahmad says he plans to return to Oklahoma City.
Yes, I do. I've been living in Oklahoma City for the past 10 years. I love Oklahoma and I love the people in Oklahoma.
Ahmad says the government should apologize for targeting him on the basis of his ethnic background. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
The United Nations War Crimes Tribunal is hearing its first case. A Bosnian Serb has been charged with war crimes such as murder, rape, and torture, mostly against Bosnian Muslims. The BBC's James Robbins reports.
Dusan Tadic listened on headphones to a Serbian translator as the presiding judge, an American, asked him if he was ready to plead to the detailed charges, which include crimes against humanity. He replied he was not guilty and had taken no part in any of the crimes. The charges detail torture and murder of civilians, mostly Muslims, at the Omarska camp in northwestern Bosnia in 1992. Tadic allegedly raped, beat and killed prisoners. If he is eventually convicted, Dusan Tadic faces life imprisonment, the maximum penalty the United Nations Tribunal can impose. Similar war crimes charges have been made against 20 other Serbs, but they've so far escaped arrest by staying in Serb-held territory. The tribunal is well aware of the problems it faces pursuing a new generation of war criminals 50 years on from the Nazi era. But the United Nations is determined to demonstrate international revulsion, even if the killings in Bosnia have not been stopped.
James Robbins reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has dropped a point and a third to 4,298. This is NPR. The B-52 bomber that crashed last June at Fairchild Air Force Base in Washington State almost hit a bunker holding nuclear weapons. The information was released in papers related to the court-martial of a Fairchild official. From member station KUOW, Guy Nelson reports.
Four crew members died in the crash. An Air Force report on the accident released last fall blamed the pilot for flying recklessly at low altitude while practicing for an air show. The base's wing commander, Colonel William Pellerin, will face a court-martial in June for dereliction of duty, and those proceedings revealed the bomber crashed 50 feet away from the base's nuclear storage area. Several eyewitnesses say it appeared the pilot made a last-ditch attempt to avoid crashing into the weapons area. The Air Force won't confirm there were nuclear weapons near the crash site, but an earlier report by the Natural Resources Defense Council said there were more than 400 nuclear bombs and missiles stored at the base. Experts say the crash would not have caused a nuclear explosion, but it could have blown up the warheads and produced a deadly plume of radiation. For National Public Radio, this is Guy Nelson in Seattle.
New research suggests that teenagers get hooked on low-nicotine chewing tobacco and then move to stronger brands. Studies released today in the journal Tobacco Control say that acidic tobacco releases nicotine into the bloodstream far more slowly than alkaline tobacco, and the National Institutes of Health and the American Health Foundation report the mildest brand of smokeless tobacco is 1,000 times more acidic than the strongest brand. The government says orders for durable goods rose 0.6% in March. The strong measure of manufacturing health has surprised some analysts. Many expected higher interest rates would slow down new orders. The increase in March comes after a decline in February. The Commerce Department says the rise in durable goods orders was led by a 6% jump in electrical equipment. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Associated Press is quoting a law enforcement official who says three people have placed Timothy McVeigh at the federal building in Oklahoma City less than 10 or 15 minutes before it was blown up. The AP also quoted the official as saying a handwritten note mentioning vehicle trouble was also found in McVeigh's car. This raises the theory he put it there so it wouldn't be towed and would be available as a getaway car. A federal prosecutor says McVeigh called his friend Terry Nichols from Oklahoma City 3 days before the bombing and told him, quote, something big is going to happen. Nichols is being held as a material witness in the bombing. The prosecutor says Terry Nichols has told FBI agents about the conversation. He did so after he was taken into custody. Meanwhile, workers at the Oklahoma City bombing site stopped for a moment today. The workers, residents of Oklahoma, and people across the country observed a minute of silence for all those killed or injured in the bombing. NPR's Art Silverman reports from Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City residents observed a minute of silence at 9:02 a.m. today. That was the time a car bomb tore the side off a federal office building last Wednesday. At churches throughout the city, bells tolled, parishioners stood outside in the bright sun and steady wind to pray aloud or to themselves. Oklahoma Governor Frank Keating and his wife joined search and rescue crews near the site of the bombing. Workers stopped in their gruesome task to join hands and bow their heads. On the freeways and streets of the city, cars pulled over to the side of the road to honor the dead, the wounded, the missing, and the bereaved. Radio and TV stations suspended programs, screens silently showing the damaged facade of the Murrah building. Today's wind is a safety concern. Removal of debris, human remains, and the search for survivors continues. This is Art Silverman in Oklahoma City.
President Clinton attended the Maryland funeral of a Secret Service agent who was killed in the bombing. Agent Alan Witcher had been assigned to the president's detail until he transferred to the federal building in Oklahoma City. Mr. Clinton says Witcher excelled in all aspects of his life.
He was the kind of man every parent wants his or her son to be, the kind of friend every wife hopes to have in a husband, the kind of father every child deserves.
President Clinton. Some Army instructors are leveling charges of a cover-up in the training deaths of four Army Ranger students. The instructors at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida say their commander, Major General John Hendricks, covered up information about conditions and events on the February night of the deaths. They charge he's altered the facts and issued punishments to appease the public. The instructors have been suspended without pay since last month after Hendricks said breakdown in their leadership led to the deaths. Hendricks has not commented on the latest issue. Stocks closed mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow fell more than a point to close at 42.99. This is NPR. Russians are basking in the warmest spring in recorded history. But as NPR's Ann Garrels reports, spring is not an ecologically good time in Russia.
For the second time in the past week, a pipeline is ruptured in western Siberia in the heart of Russia's biggest oil-producing region. First, a corroded pipe spilled 42,000 cubic feet of crude oil over 74 acres. Then a tractor plowed into a pipeline, springing a leak of 9,000 cubic feet. The major spill last year in the far north Komi Republic has been frozen, but warm spring weather threatens to unleash a flood of oil three times the size of the 1989 Exxon Valdez disaster in Alaska. The World Bank has approved a $99 million loan to help combat that spill. According to a member of President Yeltsin's Security Council, Alexei Yablokov, Russian pipelines leak about 3 million tons of oil a year. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
The Supreme Court has struck down a federal law banning guns near schools. The court ruled 5-4 that Congress had no authority to enact the law because it's not a matter of interstate commerce. The 1990 law bans possession of a gun within 1,000 feet of a school. The court rejected the Clinton administration's argument that gun possession near schools could result in violent crime, which in turn can harm the national economy. The Texas case stems from a high school student who was convicted for carrying a gun to school. The student says he was paid to deliver the gun to someone else to use in what he called a gang war. A mail bombing suspect has written a letter to the New York Times claiming his immediate goal is the, quote, destruction of the worldwide industrial system. Authorities say the letter is one of three sent by the so-called Unabomber. They were mailed before Monday's fatal bombing in Sacramento, in which a timber industry lobbyist was killed. The letter claims the bomber belongs to a group that aims to, quote, promote social instability. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.